Today's submitted material is a transcript from a marriage course focusing on the 5 love languages and the lifelong commitment required to maintain a marital relationship. Frameworks relying on mutual vulnerability fundamentally require a baseline of emotional safety that is unfortunately absent in high conflict or coercive dynamics.
Right. And we really see this clearly in how the source material just assumes both partners are equally eager and safe to engage.
Yeah. Like, take that anecdote right near the beginning of the text.
The one with the young husband?
Exactly. The guy who, you know, had never really heard loving words growing up, but he willingly and proactively learns to use words of affirmation to improve his marriage.
Yeah.
It's presented as this wonderfully simple cause and effect equation. Like, he learned the tool, he applied it, and boom, 6 months later, his wife felt completely different about their relationship.
Which is great, but it assumes this perfectly level playing field. And relying on a universal baseline of relational goodwill is, well, it's a massive blind spot here.
A huge one.
The fundamental weakness in this section is that the text completely omits any consideration for couples who are experiencing severe trauma or, you know, acute mental health crises.
Or emotional abuse.
Right, or massive trust violations like a recent infidelity. When a curriculum treats a struggling marriage purely as a communication issue, it completely ignores situations where the core system of the relationship is fundamentally compromised.
It treats it like it's just a matter of translating one vocabulary to another.
Exactly. In a healthy dynamic, learning that your partner's love language is, say, physical touch or acts of service, is highly empowering.
Oh, for sure.
But in a toxic or highly conflicted dynamic, these very same concepts can be, and honestly often are, completely weaponized.
Yeah, we have to consider the reality of a partner coercively demanding physical touch.
Oh, yes.
Or demanding these exhausting acts of service under the guise of just, you know, following the curriculum.
The material inadvertently provides this new vocabulary that a manipulative partner could use to extract compliance.
Rather than build intimacy, yeah.
But look, I hear what you're saying about the danger of weaponizing the curriculum. But if I'm the author of this material, I'm immediately going to push back here.
Okay, what's the pushback? I'm writing a marriage enhancement course, right? Not a clinical therapy manual. So if I start front-loading the text with heavy warnings about abuse, trauma, and coercion, doesn't that just completely ruin the warm, encouraging tone?
I get that.
Like, I want to invite people into a hopeful process, not make them sign a medical liability waiver before they can even start.
And that is a completely valid concern. You want to protect the warmth of the work. However, ignoring the reality of high-conflict dynamics doesn't protect the reader. It abandons them. Think about it this way. Applying love languages to a deeply broken marriage is like arguing over the interior decorating of a house while the foundation is actively crumbling.
Oh, that's a really good way to put it.
Right. Like, you can put up the most beautiful wallpaper, you can perfectly speak your partner's love language, but painting the walls will not stop the structure from collapsing if the concrete beneath it is fractured.
Yeah, if a couple is dealing with active addiction, or a fundamental lack of psychological safety, telling them to focus on giving better gifts or spending more quality time isn't just ineffective.
It's deeply disorienting.
It forces the victim in the dynamic to focus on accommodating the other person's preferences while their own fundamental psychological need for safety remains entirely unmet.
Exactly. If the brain is stuck in a fight-or-flight response, the prefrontal cortex, which is, you know, the part of the brain responsible for empathy and connection and learning new emotional languages, it's entirely inaccessible.
So how do the authors actually bridge that gap?
The suggestion here is to implement a crucial step zero before the main curriculum even begins.
Okay, step zero.
The material must explicitly define the limits of the course, providing boundaries that acknowledge when these communication tools are insufficient and when professional clinical help is a non-negotiable prerequisite.
We really have to move away from the idea that this course is a universal panacea for all marital woes.
Right.
All right, so if we're adding a step zero, what does that look like practically on the page? How do we insert this without it reading like the terms and conditions on a pharmaceutical drug?
It can be done with immense compassion and grace. First, just add a clear, highly visible disclaimer at the beginning of the study journal.
Okay.
And ideally, have the host speak it in the first few minutes of the audio or video course. This disclaimer should gently but firmly recommend professional counseling for ongoing severe conflict or trust breaches.
It's simply about saying, you know, If your marriage is currently in crisis, we love you, but this course is not your starting point. Please seek clinical support first.
Precisely. Second, provide a relational safety check exercise before diving into the specific love languages.
Oh, I like that. What would that be?
It would be a preliminary journal prompt asking couples to mutually affirm their commitment to non-coercive participation. It establishes a firm ground rule that these tools are designed exclusively for mutual blessing.
Never for demanding compliance.
Exactly. Finally, and perhaps most importantly for integrating this into the actual narrative flow, they need to include a realistic case study of a couple who realizes they need a mediator.
Yeah, because right now we only see couples who perfectly applied the tools and fixed their marriage in 6 months.
Right. Instead, show a scenario in the text where a couple attempts an exercise, realizes their conflict is way too deep, and successfully seeks out a professional therapist to establish basic emotional safety.
And they have to do that before they can even begin to practice something as vulnerable as quality time.
Exactly. It validates the experience of couples who are struggling beyond what a simple conversation can fix.
And it normalizes asking for outside help, which actually makes the rest of the material much more credible.
Absolutely.
Now, speaking of credibility, if we assume the couple has established that baseline safety, we still have a mechanical problem with how the advice is executed day to day.
Oh, definitely.
Reducing emotional connection to a checklist of preferred actions inadvertently fosters a transactional dynamic rather than a deeply empathetic one.
The source material leans incredibly heavy into lists and metrics and tracking.
Yeah, like Sila's highly specific 12-point list of preferred moments.
Right, ranging from going to Paris to walking on a beach in Ireland.
And then we hear about Nikki, who requests to be complimented every single day for at least 2 weeks after he builds a shelf.
2 weeks of compliments? For one shelf? And while the text presents these stories lightheartedly, it establishes a framework where love is quantified by specific, trackable, output-driven metrics.
Exactly. And while the material explicitly warns couples against the mindset of, you know, I did this for you, so you do this for me.
They say that, yeah.
But the heavy emphasis on delivering these highly specific requested actions creates a rigid, transactional environment anyway.
The weakness here is the incredibly high risk of emotional burnout. This tracking system completely fails to account for the reality of fluctuating emotional bandwidths.
Right, because human beings are not vending machines where you input a specific action and output a feeling of love.
Exactly. When you gamify a relationship, you shift the brain's focus from intrinsic motivation, doing something because you genuinely love them, to extrinsic motivation, where you were doing it simply to check off a box on their 12-point list.
And once love becomes an extrinsic chore, the dopamine hit of spontaneous connection disappears entirely. It's just replaced by the cortisol of trying to meet a quota.
Yep.
But hold on, let me play devil's advocate again here.
Go for it.
People need concrete tasks, right? Otherwise, they just nod along to the theory and do absolutely nothing. If Scylla's 12-point list gives her husband a clear roadmap to her heart, isn't that just good communication?
And if Nikki wants compliments for 14 days and his wife delivers, isn't that a win? Why are we punishing people for following the instructions?
Because the instructions lack an understanding of human capacity. If a partner is dealing with clinical depression, profound grief, or just the sheer crushing exhaustion of raising toddlers,
or a high-stress job, right, they genuinely lack the capacity to speak the other's primary love language perfectly. Under the rigid rubric provided by this material, the other partner is almost trained to feel unloved because their specific criteria weren't met.
They completely miss the context of their spouse's internal world.
Yes. It is exactly like downloading a calorie counting app for a highly rigid nutritional diet. On day one, you feel empowered. You're tracking every single gram of protein.
I've been there.
But by day 14, you are so stressed about perfectly logging a single almond that you refuse to go out to dinner with your friends.
Wow. Yeah. The tool designed to make you healthy actually isolates you and ruins the joy of the meal. You're sitting at the table so focused on the math that you forget to actually taste the food.
That is exactly what happens when you treat love languages like compliance metrics. If I'm terrified of forgetting to compliment my spouse for 14 consecutive days, I am no longer operating out of spontaneous love.
You're operating out of compliance and fear of failure.
Exactly.
That makes complete sense. When the metric for success is solely based on task completion, grace is entirely removed from the equation. So the suggestion here is that the material needs to fundamentally shift its angle.
Yes. It must move from a static, task-based to-do list to a fluid, dynamic conversation about fluctuating emotional capacity and mutual grace.
The curriculum must teach couples how to pivot when their partner is running on empty.
Right. Moving from demand-based love, which says, you must love me in this exact way today, to grace-based accommodation.
Which says, I see that you're totally depleted, so I will receive your love in whatever way you can possibly offer it today.
Yes.
So what are some highly concrete ways the authors can weave this concept of fluctuating capacity into the existing exercises? Because we still want them to understand each other's preferences. We just need like a pressure release valve.
The most immediate addition would be a capacity check-in exercise.
Okay.
Imagine if before starting their weekly date night or going through the journal prompts, the couple starts by simply rating their emotional bandwidth out of 10.
Oh, I like that.
If one partner says, I am operating at a 2 today, work was brutal, that immediately establishes realistic expectations. It prevents the other partner from taking a lack of grand romantic gestures personally.
The mirror neurons can actually fire in sympathy rather than defensiveness.
Exactly. Second, modify the journal prompts to introduce a grace pass question.
A grace pass.
Ask the couples to discuss and write down, how can I show you love when I am running on empty? And what low effort actions make you feel secure? This gives them a mutually agreed upon contingency plan for hard seasons.
That's brilliant.
And lastly, present a scenario in the text that models the specific grace. Present a story where a husband, whose primary language is acts of service, recognizes that his wife is completely overwhelmed.
So instead of feeling unloved because she hasn't cooked or run errands,
he actively chooses to feel loved simply by her quiet presence on the couch. He consciously overrides his primary love language to accommodate her depleted capacity.
That demonstrates profound emotional maturity. I love that. It takes the burden of performance right off the couple.
It really does.
But you know, even if a couple has the emotional bandwidth to practice these tools, this course throws up a second, massive barrier, and that's financial bandwidth. Relational advice resonates most deeply when its practical applications are accessible across diverse socioeconomic and cultural realities.
Which isn't exactly the case here.
Not at all. When we look at the source material, the anecdotes used to illustrate these concepts represent an incredibly specific, highly privileged demographic.
Yeah, we are reading about European road trips to Greece in sports cars.
Couples taking a 3-year sabbatical to live in Japan.
3 years.
Casually installing double-ended baths in a remodeled home, and weekend trips to Paris. The exclusivity of those examples is jarring. When we evaluate this underlying socioeconomic bubble, we have to recognize how severely it alienates a vast portion of the audience.
The profound weakness here is that the material inadvertently implies that successful marriage maintenance requires significant disposable income.
And abundant free time.
And adherence to Western cultural norms. It paints a picture where deep connection happens on foreign beaches or in custom-built bathtubs.
Right. But what about couples who are managing multi-generational households under one roof?
Exactly.
What about couples working multiple overlapping shifts just to make rent, who literally do not have 2 hours in the middle of the day to go for a leisurely walk in the park?
Furthermore, the material heavily favors Western ideals of overt public physical affection and private child-free dates. Couples from cultural backgrounds with different boundaries around touch, modesty, or the role of the extended family are going to struggle deeply to see themselves reflected in these examples.
But wait, let's look at it from the author's side. Aren't these the author's actual authentic lives?
Sure, they are.
If they actually took a sabbatical in Japan or drove a sports car through Greece, shouldn't they use their real stories? Are we just telling them to censor their own success and invent fake lower class stories just to pander to the audience?
We aren't asking them to censor their authenticity. We are asking them to be effective teachers.
Okay, fair.
If you're a financial advisor giving a seminar to an audience of minimum wage workers and you tell them the secret to wealth is to simply invest their spare $1 million in real estate, it instantly breaks trust.
Oh, completely.
Even if the underlying principle, like compound interest, is fundamentally true, The listener checks out because the packaging is so completely divorced from their daily reality.
The medium steps on the message. If you tell a couple drowning in debt and childcare responsibilities that the ultimate expression of quality time is booking a spontaneous trip to Paris, you're inspiring them.
No, you are highlighting what they cannot afford, which breeds resentment and disconnection.
When a reader feels the text isn't for them, they immediately dismiss the core psychological truth hidden inside the extravagant story.
Exactly. So the suggestion is a significant stylistic overhaul of the supporting anecdotes. They don't have to remove their personal stories entirely, but they must actively diversify the examples surrounding them to prove that these tools work in any environment.
The tone must be grounded in realistic, low-cost, and culturally varied scenarios.
Right.
So let's get specific. How do they anchor these high-flying concepts back down to earth?
First, they need to strongly supplement those extravagant examples with accessible counterpoints. Immediately after highlighting the Paris trip, introduce a scenario of a couple finding deep, meaningful connection during a shared 30-minute commute to work.
Or a couple sitting quietly on the front porch with a cup of instant coffee after finally putting three kids to bed in a cramped apartment.
That phrasing.
Second, they need an example of acts of service that steps completely outside the Western nuclear family bubble. Bring in an example that involves navigating a complex cultural family obligation.
Like, what does an act of service look like in a collectivist culture?
Exactly. Perhaps it's a partner managing the care of an aging in-law or navigating expectations around a massive extended family gathering, deeply honoring their spouse's cultural heritage.
That's a great example.
Finally, the study journal needs an exercise focused exclusively on free or highly time-efficient expressions of love. Give them a prompt designed specifically for couples navigating intense financial hardship or brutal work seasons.
Ask them to identify ways to communicate absolute devotion that cost $0 and take less than 5 minutes.
Right, that grounds the advice right at the kitchen table.
It really does. Now, if the daily examples feel a bit out of reach for the average reader, the ultimate cosmic goal presented at the end of the material is even more alienating. Elevating marriage to a cosmic or societal duty without explicitly grounding it at everyday partnership risks overwhelming couples with unrealistic pressure.
The text takes this massive, dramatic tonal shift at the very end. We move from practical, somewhat mundane discussions about who makes the morning tea
and how to buy a battery-powered pencil sharpener.
Right, straight into a heavy historical quote from Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He describes marriage as an office, a status, and a divine ordinance, responsible for perpetuating the human race and acting as a post of responsibility towards all of mankind.
The pacing of that shift literally gives the reader whiplash. We go from the micromechanics of daily life to the macro survival of the human species in the span of like three paragraphs.
But we have to understand who Bonhoeffer was to understand why this is so heavy. He was a brilliant German theologian who was literally executed by the Nazis. His writings deal with ultimate life, death, and existential resistance.
And taking his massive, historically weighted theology and applying it to a modern suburban couple trying to figure out who should empty the dishwasher creates severe cognitive dissonance.
The weakness of ending on this specific note is that for couples who are barely surviving the week or actively working through deep conflicts,
just trying to decide if they even want to stay together.
Exactly. This overarching societal demand feels absolutely crushing. It places a tremendous burden of global significance squarely on the shoulders of two very tired people.
When you tell a struggling couple that their private relationship is actually a public office responsible for the glory of God and the continuation of mankind, it's much more likely to induce profound guilt and a sense of colossal failure rather than any sense of inspiration.
Right.
But I have to challenge that a bit. I actually kind of like that they elevate the institution. I mean, marriage is treated so casually today, often just as a temporary contract of convenience. Doesn't it need some gravity? Shouldn't we remind people that staying together actually matters to the world?
Gravity is excellent, but crushing weight is paralyzing. It is like telling a novice runner, someone who is just trying to find the motivation to jog around their neighborhood block for 10 minutes, that their morning run is absolutely essential for the future survival of Olympic sports.
And the enduring legacy of athletic excellence?
Right. Rather than motivating them to tie their shoes and get out the door, It completely paralyzes them with the sheer weight of the expectations. They might just look at the shoes, decide the stakes are impossibly high, and sit back down on the couch.
We want couples to feel the dignity of the institution, but we don't want them to feel crushed by it. If they are already exhausted by Scylla's 12-point checklist, telling them the human race depends on their marriage might be the thing that makes them quit entirely.
So to mitigate this paralysis, the suggestion is to fundamentally soften the landing. They shouldn't necessarily scrap the Bonhoeffer quote. I mean, it clearly holds deep philosophical meaning for the authors.
Sure.
But they must explicitly connect the micro actions discussed throughout the entire course directly to this macro vision. They need to frame the office of marriage not as a terrifying global burden, but as a highly localized, supportive micro environment.
Exactly. How do they actually execute that transition on the page, though?
They can bridge the gap by reframing the application of the quote immediately after it's read. They need to add a clarifying, grounding sentence, something like, "Fulfilling this high office doesn't mean you have to change the whole world today. It simply means creating a peaceful, secure home for your children or providing a stable, loving presence for your immediate neighborhood."
Oh, that makes it so much more approachable.
Second, they should create an actionable closing exercise. Ask the couple to identify just one small way their combined teamwork can help a specific friend, neighbor, or family member this week.
Maybe it's just hosting a tired single-parent friend for dinner?
Yes, that translates the massive responsibility to mankind into something highly achievable and community-focused.
And finally, and I think this is absolutely crucial, for the couples who are really struggling, the closing remarks must explicitly validate that during hard seasons, simply surviving together, maintaining the bond, and not giving up is the successful fulfillment of that higher dignity.
Surviving the winter is just as honorable as blooming in the spring.
That is beautifully said. It brings grand ideals into compassionate, realistic practice. Well, to recap our critique today, we explored four major structural pivots.
Mm-hmm.
First, we addressed the necessity of establishing a clear baseline for relational safety, ensuring these communication tools aren't weaponized in high conflict dynamics.
Right.
Second, we explored the psychological need to shift from a rigid, transactional checklist of love languages to a capacity-aware model that accommodates fluctuating emotional bandwidths with grace, preventing extrinsic burnout.
Exactly.
Third, we discussed the absolute importance of broadening the socioeconomic and cultural relevance of the anecdotes, moving beyond sports cars and European vacations to include the realities of time-poor, culturally diverse couples.
Crucial step.
And finally, we looked at how to ground that heavy cosmic theological conclusion in localized daily reality, reducing the paralysis of expectation on overwhelmed couples.
To put those pivots into action, the immediate next steps are clear. Insert a firm safety disclaimer and a relational check-in tool before the course begins, explicitly defining when clinical intervention is required.
Introduce a capacity out of 10 communication exercise and a grace pass journal prompt.
Systematically weave in zero-cost, culturally diverse, and highly relatable examples to balance the stories of privilege.
And lastly, follow the Bonhoeffer quote with practical exercises that connect the grand purpose of marriage to achievable community-level actions.
This material has a wonderfully well-intentioned foundation that clearly desires to help people connect. With these structural adjustments, it will be robust enough to support any couple that walks through the door, no matter what heavy baggage they might be carrying.
Thank you so much for submitting this transcript. We warmly invite you to submit your revised material for a future critique.